Welcome to another issue of David Greenwalt's Mastermind Power Coaching Club audio tape series. For this interview, David spoke with Dr. Peter Lemon, PhD, who is currently a professor in the Health Sciences and Kinesiology Department at the University of Western Ontario in Canada. Dr. Lemon is considered one of the foremost experts with regard to the protein needs of exercising adults and has been published in respected, peer-reviewed journals dozens of times over the past 20 or more years. He is probably most widely recognized as the first to go against the grain and suggest that exercising adults have a higher protein need than their sedentary counterparts. Since this work in the early 1980s, Dr. Lemon has continued to study the special dietary needs of the athlete, and through this interview with David, Dr. Lemon shares his tremendous wealth of knowledge with you. If you are not presently a member of David's Mastermind Power Coaching Club, then please listen to the end of the tape for information telling you exactly how you can go about joining. For now, sit back, put your thinking cap on, and listen to David Greenwalt and Peter Lemon as they discuss the role protein plays in your nutritional strategy and the special needs of the exercising adult.
Welcome everyone to another exciting edition of David Interviews the Experts. Today I am in Dixon, Illinois, and I'm interviewing protein expert Dr. Peter Lemon in Western Ontario, Canada. Those of you familiar with Medline and legitimate peer-reviewed research will understand why I'm so excited to be interviewing such a well-respected member of academia and someone who has published dozens of papers on the protein needs of athletes. Welcome, Dr. Lemon, and thank you for taking time out of your busy day to educate my listeners about protein and the special needs of certain individuals.
My pleasure, Dave.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to have such a strong interest in researching the protein needs of athletes, or at least certain populations?
Sure. First of all, I'm a professor at the University of Western Ontario, and I hold the Weider Research Chair. And I became interested in studying protein way back as a graduate student. Believe it or not, it was a simple project that one of my mentors suggested that I look into. And I was expecting to spend about 3 or 4 weeks on it. And here we are many years later. I'm still working on similar areas.
When did this begin? When did this mentor suggest a project? And when was that, when you thought it was going to be 3 or 4 weeks?
1975.
So you've been doing this for going on 26 years now.
That's right.
That's amazing. I've read a lot of your papers, and I've told you even before the interview that I'm very excited. I mean, I really feel like I'm dealing with a celebrity when it comes to protein experts, and I really appreciate you taking time to do the interview today. Why should athletes or certain classes of individuals be concerned about their protein intake?
Well, Dave, I think there's a couple of reasons. First of all, protein in the diet forms the building blocks for a couple of different important components, not only muscle, if you're interested in building mass and strength, but also functional protein. And when I refer to functional protein, I'm talking about the enzymes involved in various metabolic pathways within the body. So whether you're talking about providing the machinery to contract muscle, or whether you're talking about the functional protein to provide the energy in order to not only contract muscle, but any of the processes in the body, one needs protein. And you're not able to make it exclusively in your body. You must consume it in the diet in order to be able to make protein efficiently.
Can you explain in a little more detail the difference between us being concerned about the functional protein and the protein that probably most of the listeners are going to be familiar with, and they're going to be thinking that, you know, protein builds muscle. That's the common thought, is that if I consume protein, I can build muscle, or I will build muscle, or it will build muscle. What's the difference between the functional protein properties and the contractile tissue that can be built if adequate protein and other stimulus is available?
Well, as you know, the component parts of protein are amino acids.
Right.
And those are broken down in the process of digestion and then rebuilt into structural protein, muscle. But in addition to that, those same amino acids can make other proteins. They can make enzymes which will speed up chemical reactions that enable you to actually generate energy for the process of exercise or to actually build the structural protein that we're talking about. So there are proteins necessary in order for you to reassemble the amino acids to make muscle.
So just for clarity, And I understand what you're saying, but I want to make sure that our listeners do. People correlate protein consumption with muscle only. However, you can tell me and tell our listeners, generally speaking, how many different kinds of proteins there are in the body. And that's what you're talking about here with respect to enzymes and the functional proteins. Muscle isn't just protein, and protein isn't used for just muscle. The proteins in the body are in the hundreds, aren't there?
Yes, many, many different types of proteins. If you think just about one trying to exercise, you must provide energy in order to do that, regardless of how much muscle you have. And many of the amino acids in your body are used to actually produce the energy to allow muscle to contract.
And what energy specifically are you speaking of with regard to the protein?
Well, typically with exercise, as you know, carbohydrates are the major fuel for exercise. They
Right.
provide the energy. However, in situations where carbohydrate is depleted, either through inadequate intake or through excessive exercise, one can utilize muscle protein as fuel. And this is something one wants to avoid, or else increases in muscle strength and size will not occur.
Okay, very good. Now, one of the questions that does come to mind for me is, you're talking about protein being used as an energy source. You know, people that are taught throughout their nutritional education that, you know, carbohydrates are the cleanest, most efficient energy source that we have. Proteins can be used as an energy source, but it seems like most of the literature and whatnot will tell us that only about up to 15% maybe of our available energy needs can be met with protein. Is that true? How should we be thinking of this? I don't want our listeners to think necessarily that protein should be the primary energy source. When is it going to be used more as an energy source, and why would that be important if carbohydrate is available?
Well, you're correct in your statement that protein is a minor contributor to total energy requirements of an individual.
Okay.
Carbohydrate and fat, actually, are the major energy sources. However, that's when we're dealing with a normal situation. When you're talking about someone who's training very hard, who has very high energy demands, there is an increased reliance on protein. We're probably talking about, under normal circumstances, maybe about 5% of the energy is coming from protein. And that could increase to maybe as high as 10% or a little higher.
Okay.
So your 15% is probably a little high.
Okay.
But the point is that in some circumstances, this can become significant. In other words, if you're exercising very strenuously and not consuming enough energy, one can actually increase the utilization of protein, and that would be at the expense of building muscle strength and size. So one needs to be careful when you talk about how much protein is necessary, because it can change based on your energy expenditure and your dietary intake.
Okay, great. We're going to get into that a little bit more later, I know for sure. So I'm going to leave that for just a moment and move right into the RDA. Is the current RDA enough, in your opinion? Why or why not? And what athletes need more than the RDA? I mean, we're talking about, you know, weightlifters to a certain extent, but it goes beyond that, and I'd like you to explain that a little bit. First, the RDA, and then what particular classes of individuals need to be most concerned.
Okay, first of all, you have to understand that the RDA, or the recommendation relative to protein intake, was based on studies on essentially sedentary people. So it wasn't designed for athletes, either strength or endurance athletes. And so if you ask me if that's adequate, it certainly is for a sedentary person, the
Sure.
individuals on which it was designed for. However, more recent studies with athletes, both strength and endurance athletes in strenuous training, suggest that the RDA for sedentary people is not adequate. And in fact, if you look at data for strength athletes, the recommendation probably is close to double what it is for sedentary people, and for endurance athletes, it's about 50% higher. Again, there's wide variation, and if your energy intake is inadequate, as we talked about just a few minutes ago,
uh-huh.
you may need even more protein. But we're talking about in the range of about 1.6 to 1.8 grams per kilogram of body mass for strength athletes, and probably in the range of about 1.2 to 1.4 grams per kilogram for an endurance athlete. Now, some of your listeners, I'm sure, will say, well, gee, that's not very much protein. A lot of athletes consume way more than that. one of the questions that's being looked at now is whether there's any advantage to going above those levels.
Right.
And that's where the debate really is focused now. I think many people would concede that trainee athletes require more protein than inactive individuals. The question is how much? And we could debate that probably for the next half an hour.
Exactly. And what you said is very true. There are a lot of, not so much endurance athletes, but competitive powerlifters and bodybuilders that I personally know who consume, if they're 200-plus pounds of body mass, they consume 300 to 400 grams of protein per day.
Yes.
And when I'm consulting with them, I tell them that's probably a little high, and, of course, their response is, look at my results.
Mm-hmm.
And I just base my response based on science and a lot of what you have said and what you've published over the years, and I'm going to stick to that because that's what science currently tells us. So I completely agree with you. I understand what you're saying, and I just want our listeners to know that I appreciate the fact that you already are aware of and recognize the fact that there are people doing that. They're 400 grams a day, whatever, or more.
Yeah, and I think we need to understand that just because they are very successful doesn't mean that that is the ideal way to go.
Right.
There was a study done, which you're probably aware of, I guess 9-10 years ago now, by Mark Tarnopolsky, where he actually fed individuals three different intakes of protein. One was right around the RDA. One was 1.4 grams per kg, and the third diet was 2.4 grams per kg. And he compared the body's ability to make protein on those three diets in a sedentary group and in a group of strength athletes. And one of the things that he found, which I think is very interesting, is that when you went from the RDA level of protein to 1.4 in the strength athletes, there was actually an increase in the rate at which the body could make protein, which over time would produce bigger and stronger muscles. That was not found in the sedentary people, which would confirm what we just talked about.
Right.
That is that the requirements in order to build muscle are higher. But equally exciting, I think, was the fact that when he looked at the strength athletes on the 2.4 gram per kg diet, there was no further increase relative to the 1.4, which would suggest that they had surpassed the optimal amount when they went to 2.4. So it could be that consuming several hundred grams, 300-400 grams a day, produces great results, but maybe substantially less would produce the same effect.
Right.
And so we need to keep that in mind, too, that just because somebody does something and is successful doesn't mean that that's the optimal way. They might have been successful with two or three other strategies.
Exactly. Excellent. Thank you. Now, we can store fat, and we can store carbohydrate. Can we store protein?
Not in the same way. As you point out, fat and carbohydrate both are stored for energy reserves, and it goes way back to when food wasn't readily available. The individuals who could store energy could survive long periods where food was not available. That's not a problem now, at least in the West, where food is plentiful.
Right.
The only protein you store in your body is actually in tissue like, say, muscle or the enzymatic protein that we talked about before. So it's a structure or functional protein. There is no reserve of energy. So if you start to use protein for energy, as you would in a starvation situation, you're actually catabolizing your own body tissue.
Right.
Now, if you think of fat, it's very efficiently stored in periods of plentiful food supply for situations where you don't have that food. So if you have a little more fat, you'll survive longer when food is not available. And that has great survival value, and that's probably why we're so good at storing energy in the form of fat. That was selected for over years of evolution. So protein is not stored in the same way as either carbohydrate or fat.
So the protein reserves, as they may be called, are exceptionally low by comparison to fat or carbohydrate, and that would be one of the reasons that we generally need to consume protein on a daily basis, or would you say that the frequency of protein consumption needs to be split out over multi-servings per day, or is it just okay to get the 1.4 to 1.8 gram per kg once per day, or what are your thoughts on that since we can't store it?
That's very complicated question.
Okay.
First of all, we definitely need protein every day. Whether it's better to consume it in a bolus amount or multiple intakes during the day is another area that's being looked into now.
Okay.
and there's some data on either side of the issue. It may relate to how old you are. It may relate to your expenditure levels. There are several confounding factors. But if one doesn't consume protein on a regular basis, your ability to repair protein within the body and build new protein is definitely adversely affected. So if one is going to consume protein, you know, every other day, every 3 or 4 days, there's going to be some impact on your ability to replace protein that's broken down.
And that may describe some individuals listening who are vegetarians, if they're not careful.
Well, it could be. The protein, or more correctly, the amino acids in vegetables are not always complete, fruits and vegetables. So one needs to be careful to consume an adequate mixture close enough in time so that you can use all of those amino acids to build muscle protein. There are vegetarian athletes who are very successful.
Sure.
But you have to be a little bit more knowledgeable. And because the efficiency of digestion of fruits and vegetables is less, you need to consume more total food. So from the standpoint of maybe not mixing and getting all the amino acids in the right proportions, and also perhaps not getting enough energy, both of those factors can impact on your ability to build muscle protein.
Okay, great. I'm going to move into a really complicated subject for probably our listeners, and it has been for me, and just trying to understand it. But I want to talk about nitrogen balance for a moment. Nitrogen balance is discussed heavily in many papers where adequate protein needs are being discussed. What is nitrogen balance?
Well, first of all, nitrogen is one of the components within protein. And when you're talking about measuring protein requirements, frequently what is actually measured is nitrogen. And then you simply make the calculation of how much protein that nitrogen would represent. So when you think about nitrogen balance, just think about protein balance. It's essentially the same thing.
Okay.
So what we're doing with this measure is you quantify all of the nitrogen that an individual consumes in their diet. And that can simply be done by measuring duplicate meals. So I can feed you a meal, I can measure an identical meal, and I know exactly how much you've consumed. If you don't eat all the meal, then I measure what's left on the plate and subtract it from what was there when you started. So I have a measure of nitrogen intake. On the other side, if you measure all of the nitrogen that you excrete over a standard time period, so you have nitrogen intake in food, nitrogen excretion that's eliminated from the body through all routes, the difference between those two, the net difference, is nitrogen balance.
Okay.
And what you're interested in is whether that is a positive or a negative number. Very simply, if it's a positive number, that means you're retaining more nitrogen than you're excreting. And of course, that nitrogen is coming from the food. If you're excreting more than you're retaining, then that number is negative. And what that means is that you're actually breaking down more body protein than you're taking in. So you're actually getting smaller and therefore weaker in a negative nitrogen balance situation. Obviously, that's not what we want to have, not only for an athlete, but for anyone who's growing. So what we're looking for is the amount of dietary protein that one needs to at least be exactly in balance, where intake and excretion are equal. At least you're not losing in that situation.
Right.
If you're dealing with a growing person, then you want that number to be positive so that you're actually taking some of the dietary protein and you're generating protein in the body at a rate which exceeds the general wear and tear so that you're not getting smaller, but you're getting bigger.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, generally speaking, children, pregnant women, and bodybuilders who have growth left in their genetic ceiling are many times in a positive nitrogen status. With children and pregnant women, I believe the stimulus is hormonal. You can correct me if I'm wrong, and I very well could be. But with growing bodybuilders, what is the stimulus for the positive nitrogen status that they need? In other words, can the amount of protein consumed cause a positive nitrogen status, or is a positive nitrogen status dependent on the hormonal milieu present plus the amount of protein consumed?
Yeah, the latter is correct. You
okay.
need a high dietary intake of protein, and you need the anabolic stimulus of the hormones. And you're correct that in some situations, the mixture of anabolic hormones is much greater than in other situations. And it's not only related to pregnancy or growth.
Okay.
It can be related to simply what you're consuming. For example, insulin is probably the most anabolic hormone that we have. And when you consume carbohydrate and protein, the pancreas releases insulin into the blood. And what that insulin does is it causes both the carbohydrates and the proteins to be taken out of the blood and utilized by body tissues. So that's a very important hormone if you want to undergo growth. And this has led to some very interesting work in terms of what mixture of foods might be consumed in order to stimulate growth, especially relative to a strength training exercise session. Because interestingly enough, as you know, strength training produces a very powerful anabolic stimulus.
Right.
And if one can accelerate that by combining nutrient intake with that strength stimulus, one might be able to accelerate the growth process. And this is something that nobody has worked out completely, but the idea of whether one should eat right before you train, while you're training, and or immediately after, how those different intakes affect the process is something that's an ongoing research project in a number of labs right now. And it looks like that you can, in fact, influence the process. So if you were to eat, for example, within an hour after a training session, or if you were to take that same composition of food and eat it 6 hours later, the resulting growth response might be significantly different. And that's very exciting from the standpoint of anyone working with athletes, because we may be able to give recommendations that can further enhance the growth rate of muscle.
Exactly. One of the recommendations that I've been saying for quite some time now is just how important it is during that post-workout meal that you consume it as quickly as possible after your workout. And, you know, of course, like you said, the debate continues and research continues as to what exactly it should be made of, but it does seem like we're getting a little closer to finding an answer with regard to the post-workout meal. Do you agree? Or?
Yeah, definitely. A number of years ago, there was some interesting work relative to carbohydrate intake following a glycogen depletion exercise session, showing that if one consumed carbohydrate very shortly after an exercise bout, the subsequent response, the storage of carbohydrate in the muscle, was greatly enhanced. And this has led to a whole series of projects trying to enhance that recommendation. How much carbohydrate, when should it be consumed? And it's gone right into the whole idea of, well, what about if we can enhance carbohydrate recovery with carbohydrate? What about if we add some protein? What does that do?
Right.
And if we get this insulin response, this anabolic hormone, if we provide amino acids through diet at the same time,
mm-hmm.
can we speed the repair of muscle? And if you think about it, the stimulus for muscle growth may be related to microscopic damage in muscle caused by the exercise bout. And so if we can speed repair, we may be able to enhance that whole process.
Do you have any opinions at this time? This may be a little outside our realm, but do you have any opinions at this time about the post-workout meal and what the ratios of carbs and protein might be?
Oh, I'm not sure I can really
make
a guess, but I think more than the ratio of carbohydrate to protein, it may be the type of amino acids in that meal that are important. There are certain amino acids that your body can't produce, and I think a couple of those are probably the key ones. And we may find that the protein requirement that we have, not only post-exercise, but in general, is more related to a few specific amino acids. And we may be able to get an anabolic effect by providing those in combination with adequate carbohydrate following the exercise bout. And that'll be exciting because it means that you can do it with less total amount of food.
Right.
One won't have to consume massive amounts to get this effect. So I'm not sure what the ratio is, but I think you're going to find very small amounts of specific amino acids combined with carbohydrate is probably where we're going to end up in a few years with a recommendation.
Until we get to that point, if you were advising someone, it would probably be consume carbohydrate and complete proteins in a powder form, in food form? Should it be a cornflakes, you know, or is there any recommendation with regard to what kind of, at this time, since we don't know the specific amino acids that may end up becoming the stars, what they should consume in that meal?
Yeah, it should definitely be a complete protein at this point, because we're not sure exactly which amino acids are the key ones.
Okay.
So, as I mentioned, we've got some evidence. In terms of whether it is done as a powder or a food, probably doesn't matter that much as long as there is sufficient carbohydrate and protein.
Okay.
No one has done comparisons of food versus powder form at the different times to be able to answer that. But as long as the nutrients are made available, you should be able to absorb them.
And just for clarification for the listeners of this who are bombarded daily with different marketing tactics and so forth that are always trying to kind of take and twist and turn the proper terms and try and confuse the individuals that are the reader. With regard to nitrogen status and getting in a positive nitrogen status, you cannot, or you can, get in a positive nitrogen status by consuming more protein. That is not going to happen. I mean, if you don't have the proper stimulus, meaning for athletes, you know, some kind of activity or weight training or endurance activity, consuming more protein by itself is not going to put someone in a positive nitrogen status, correct? Or it will?
Well, what will happen if you simply consume excess protein without a stimulus of weight training,
with
this anabolic stimulus that we talked about before,
right,
you're not going to build more muscle. What will happen is the energy from the protein will get stored in your body as fat. The nitrogen will get excreted.
Okay.
So, yes, in the long term, you won't retain excessively high nitrogen balance because you'll be excreting. It may actually go up acutely as you make an adjustment.
Right.
But chronically, you will gain mass by consuming more protein or any foodstuff if it exceeds your expenditure. But it's not going to be muscle unless you produce the anabolic stimulus through training to divert that nitrogen into muscle growth, and the energy into muscle growth as opposed to fat stores. Unfortunately, we can't just eat 300 grams of protein a day and get big and strong.
Exactly.
That would be nice.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, it would. Yes, it would. Can I be in a positive nitrogen status or nitrogen balance and still not be growing new skeletal muscle?
Not over the long term.
Okay.
Again, acutely you can, because when you change your diet dramatically, there are some acute changes that go on that may last several days, but eventually they'll level out.
One of the reasons that I bring this up, and I just want to tell the listeners and you too, Dr. Lemon, where I'm getting at with this, there's a couple of products on the market who their marketing angle is, you know, by consuming this product, which contains nitrogen, I believe it's a creatine-based product, but by consuming X product that contains nitrogen, your nitrogen balance is going to be positive. It's going to be very high. It's going to be all of these wonderful things, and that's exactly what you need to grow muscle. And so I wanted to have this clarification, this conversation we're having today from such an expert as yourself so that we can get some clarification on really the ridiculousness of those marketing statements.
Without the exercise stimulus, which, as we talked about before, is related to changes in hormonal output, you're not going to maintain that kind of growth process other than in fat.
Okay, very good. Is there an upper limit of safety with regard to protein consumption? And what about the fear of impaired renal function that always seems to rear its ugly head?
Yeah, this is a very controversial area. First of all, definitively, it's not known if there is an upper limit. However, I think we need to qualify this in a number of ways. When we talk about recommendations in the 1.5 to even 2 grams per kg, there's all kinds of evidence that there is absolutely no problem with those types of intakes.
Okay.
Now, higher than that, there's not a lot of good evidence. However, there are a couple of studies that show athletes up into the 2.5 gram range, 2.5 grams per kg, with no adverse effects on kidney function. Probably even more important, though, is, as you know, there are a lot of bodybuilders for many years who have consumed way more than that.
Right.
And although they haven't been studied, if there was a lot of problem in any area, renal function, liver function, whatever, you would think that it would have surfaced. In other words, we'd have a lot of maybe 50 to 60-year-old men who had been bodybuilding since they were teenagers,
right,
who would have problems. and I'm not aware of any of those surfacing. Finally, I think the idea comes from studies looking at people with impaired kidney function. And if you have impaired kidney function, high protein intakes actually are ill-advised.
Right.
And it has to do with the fact that the kidney has to work harder in order to excrete all this nitrogen that you're consuming. Now, that probably has no adverse effect at all in a young, healthy person or in an older, healthy person. But if you have impaired kidney function, young or old, this is something that you probably want to look into. It may cause some problems. So I think it's an extrapolation from studies on kidney patients and not based on the type of population who we're discussing.
Great.
My guess is that the scare is vastly overemphasized, and the problems with high protein intakes, at least up until 2 to even 2.5 grams per kg, are minimal.
Well, what about the people who will also then stomp your feet, and this will be the last one with regard to safety, but the gout and urea, and your, you know, the high uric acid and whatnot, and like you say, the metabolites of protein.
This program continues at this point on Side B.
What are your thoughts on that? Same thing, if you're susceptible to it, then it could be a problem. Otherwise, if you're at the 1.5 to 2 grams per kg, once again, it's pretty safe, or in your opinion is pretty safe. What are your thoughts on
that? Yeah, I would say the same thing.
Okay.
I don't see an excessive problem with that in healthy people. If one does have problems with gout, a bout of gout, then certainly you may have to decrease protein intake.
Okay.
But these may be problems at much higher intakes than we're talking about.
Okay. There's quite a battle among manufacturers regarding which type of protein is best for bodybuilders. I've taken the position that any quality protein, and more precisely a combination of quality proteins from foods or powders or what have you, is probably best. Is there a best protein source in your opinion?
Well, you're really hitting all the controversial areas here. Yeah, this is another area that has been debated. Again, as I talked about before, the amino acids that you can't synthesize in your body and therefore have to be consumed are obviously critical. And since those are found in complete protein sources, complete proteins would be, you know, the best recommendation until we finalize exactly what is the stimulus. The different forms of protein have also been looked at a little bit, and a lot of this has been done in animals who have different requirements than we do, especially if you're studying laboratory rodents, for example, which is a model that's used a great deal. So in some cases, the estimates probably are not exactly correct for humans. I think over the long term, it's probably best to consume a mixture of complete proteins. There's some indication that some proteins may be absorbed more quickly than others, and therefore, in a post-recovery meal, you might want to consume a certain type to rapidly get it absorbed into the blood and to the muscle. If you're not going to be eating for a while, you might want to consume more of the more slowly digested proteins so that you have a more prolonged amino acid influx or availability. And maybe some combination of the two would be ideal.
Okay, great. Is there anything we should, you know, really look for then in a protein? Or, I mean, you know, some of the debates rage over soy is an inferior protein. Or some people, it's ridiculous, but I've seen some that say soy is just, it's not even a complete protein. Are there any protein sources we should avoid if our goal is to add new visible skeletal muscle? I mean, with the exception of, like, gelatin or something like that. Anything we should avoid or anything we should seek other than variety?
As a nutritionist, I always like to recommend variety. I think sometimes when the more we restrict our diet to fewer and fewer sources of foods, we eliminate things that may be beneficial that we don't fully understand exactly why they do help out. And so I would stick to a mixture of proteins. I think that's the best recommendation until we get specific information that something is better than something else.
All right, thank you. There have been recent discussions, and you had mentioned this just a minute ago, over the issues of fast versus slow dietary proteins. And basically, specifically, they'll say that, you know, casein is absorbed slower than whey. whey protein, and proponents of each proclaim, you know, some kind of victory because of the benefits of either. Is there a better time? You had mentioned that it might be better if you're going to be going quite a long time, or maybe more time than usual between meals or what have you, to take a maybe a slower protein. When you were referring to the slower protein and the faster protein, were you making a fairly general reference to casein and whey?
Actually, yeah, those are the two that have been studied. And as you mentioned, casein is absorbed more slowly and therefore provides a more constant lower supply of amino acids over time versus whey. And so there could be some advantages to one or the other relative to, as I mentioned, trying to get amino acids quickly to the muscle. But no one has actually tried an experiment where they've been able to show greater muscle growth with one or the other. And it's simply too early to be able to get that specific. But theoretically, much like a high glycemic carbohydrate provides carbohydrate more quickly versus a low glycemic carbohydrate, there may be some advantages to specific recommendations with protein. And unfortunately, the athletes, you know, want to know way before we actually have the specific information.
Oh, we want to know it all right now. Every bit of it.
I'd like to know it all right now, too, but it's...
We don't want any holes left. At the end of this interview, and preferably, if you could, Dr. Lemon, by the end of the day, if you could have every answer to every question known to man on protein, we'd appreciate it a lot.
Well, that's my goal. It takes a little longer. You know, these experiments, you know, can take months and years to actually sort out what's going on, and so... Unfortunately, we're always going to be behind the theory. I mean, you can sit back and say, theoretically, this is the way to go.
Right.
But to actually prove that it is takes months and years of work.
Exactly. Now, with regard to protein quality, since a mixture is fine, one of the things that readers of the magazines get bombarded with as well is how the proteins are rated with respect to biological value or protein efficiency ratio or the PDCAA or what have you. Is there anything when they're reading these articles that they should keep in mind, or is it just, you know what, back up, think about the basics, have enough quality protein, make sure they're complete, and ignore all that other gobbledygook?
Well, there has been quite a bit of confusion with the different types of measures, and as I alluded to before, a lot of this work has been done in animals, and I think we need to look at methods based on human work because of the different requirements. But basically, there are a number of high-quality proteins, and it probably doesn't make a whole lot of difference. If we're talking about milk protein, soy protein, whey protein, all of these are high-quality proteins. And my advice would be to stick with a mixture of them or a mixture of foods that contain them.
Right.
And not worry so much about some of these values. I don't know how they calculate some of these numbers because, by my calculations, they're impossible. Some of the
biological value above 100, for instance.
Exactly.
Yes. I'm familiar with that. I've written about that as best as I can for quite some time now, and I think it's finally taking hold. It's been spread across the industry enough, and not only through my writing, of course, but through the writings of several others who have questioned that biological value of 150. Okay, well, thank you for that. And like I say, it's just basically it's back to basics. It's varied intakes. It's a mixture of quality, complete proteins, and don't get so hung up on biological value and protein efficiency ratio and what have you. Now, here comes the big one, and I'm not kidding. If I had a nickel for every time I'm asked this question, I could retire tomorrow, I think. There is a common myth that we adults can't properly digest more than 30 grams of protein per sitting. Is there an upper limit of protein that we can consume per sitting? Is this based on body weight, gender, genetics? Is there some kind of number I can tell people that on a per-sitting basis, if you weigh X, you should not consume more than this amount of protein per kilogram of body mass or what have you? Is there any kind of guideline I can give them besides telling them that that's hogwash?
Well, I'm not sure that I can answer this definitively because although there's been some work in animals, there hasn't been a whole lot in humans on this. And I'm not sure where the original numbers came from, but certainly the rate at which proteins are absorbed in the gastrointestinal tract is related to the rate at which they're actually digested. So it does make some sense when you think about it. If digestion is slowed down, then the products of digestion entering the small intestine is slowed down, and that will impact on the rate of absorption. What the actual number is, I'm not sure. There has been some interesting work recently. Now that we're able to use isotopic tracers, we can get at this a little bit better. And certainly there are differing amounts of protein that actually appear in the blood after you consume them. So that it is possible that some types of protein may escape the digestive process and be excreted. Now, this would not invalidate the nitrogen balance measure, because these are going to be excreted primarily in stool samples, or if they're fermented in the urine samples, which are measured. So they would still be measured in the nitrogen balance technique. But what it means is that the amount that you actually get into your body relative to what you eat may differ. And I think maybe with some future experiments, different types of protein, we may find that there are actually significant differences. And this will be kind of interesting. There have been some dog experiments with protein intakes in the range of about 400 grams. And the process of digestion is slowed dramatically as you increase, say, from just a few grams up to 400 grams in a sitting. Now, the interesting part of this on the other side is that the actual absorption in the GI tract doesn't seem to be dependent on the load. And this may have to do with efficiency of absorption. Let me go back to what I was saying a minute ago. If the amount of protein that you consume slows down the rate of entry into the GI tract because the digestive process is slowed, then the movement through the GI tract could be slowed, which would provide more time for the protein to be absorbed. So the efficiency of the absorption could go up with higher intakes. So you may have a double-barreled effect here. If you eat more protein, digestion is slowed, but the actual process of getting it from the gut into the blood is actually, there's an increase in efficiency. And so we need to do some studies measuring exactly how much protein gets into the blood following these different intakes, whether it be 30 or 50 or 10 or whatever. And it gets back to one of your earlier questions about how much is optimal.
Right.
Is it 200, 300, 400 like these bodybuilders consume, or is it more down in the range of 150, which would be more like what we might predict based on our protein synthetic measures? So I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to answer the question about whether you should eat 30 grams a sitting multiple times a day, or whether 45 is better. But I think it's an interesting area to pursue, and there's not going to be a lot of labs who can make those measures because they're pretty sophisticated, and that's probably why we don't have the answer to that question.
Okay. So with regard to the, quote-unquote, magical 30 grams of protein per sitting, and since we don't know, like you say, a definitive answer on it, it simply doesn't make any sense, and maybe that's not how we should even think about these things, that whether it makes sense or not, because we need to rely on science to really give us the true picture. But it just simply doesn't make any sense to most of us that a Lou Ferrigno type, you know, a 250, 300-pound man is going to have a problem consuming a T-bone steak that has 75 to 100 grams of protein in it versus a 100-pound woman, and saying that there's some 30 gram of protein per sitting that if you go over that, it's a waste. It's just going to be excreted. So even though we can't give a definitive, it's X grams per kilogram of body mass, per meal, can you provide, just in general, and it sounds like maybe you already have, but I just want to get clarity, the idea of, the widely varying body masses that are out there, whether you're trying to lose weight, just get in shape, or whether you're going to compete, or whether you're going to be a javelin thrower or whatever, it just seems like with these huge differences in body mass that there would be some kind of a difference based on body mass, or do you feel that the absorption of protein and the digestion and so forth would have little to do with your overall body mass?
I think there's probably several factors, body mass and metabolic rate, for instance, that would be tremendously different between the two people you just described.
Okay.
That could have an effect on this. I remember recently reading a study that they had done in dogs, obviously much smaller than humans, and the percentage of protein that was absorbed over a range of protein intakes, going from very small to, less than 10 grams, up to close to 40 grams, the efficiency of absorption was essentially the same, over that whole range in a much smaller animal than either the woman or the Lou Ferrigno type that you just described.
Okay.
So if in a dog with that kind of range we have the same amount of absorption, it would seem to me that a human could handle way more than that. And perhaps someone who's bigger with a faster metabolic rate could handle even more. But again, I don't have any data on
sure.
that. It does make sense that a whole series of factors would likely influence that. I guess if you think in terms of a bodybuilder consuming hundreds of grams a day, if they could only assimilate 30 grams at a sitting,
right?
Just mathematically, that doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense.
Well, it's going to be pretty tough, too, if they're only supposed to have 30 grams per meal and they eat, on average, 6 meals a day. That's 180 grams of protein. And while science would tell us that that may be ideal for the average person trying to put on some quality muscle, these guys that are consuming 300 a day and they're still consuming 6 meals, you know, they're consuming 50 or so grams of protein per meal.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not having gastrointestinal distress and they're not, you know, cramping up and noticing some kind of digestive disorder from it. So, and I'm not going out on a limb either. I just wanted to try to demystify this 30 grams of protein per sitting. And as I said, if I had a nickel for every time I'm asked that, I'd be a very rich man.
Yeah, I think the answer will have to come from these metabolic labeling studies, because the nitrogen balance technique by its nature has to be done over a prolonged time period, at least a day and usually several days. So it would not be possible to separate out multiple times during a day with that technique just because of the length of time it takes for these substances to pass through the system. But if one uses a tracer technique where you label a compound, you ingest it, and as it's metabolized, it shows up in the blood or in some excretion mode, we can trace it. So those are the types of studies that will answer this, and some of those are going on now. So, you know, we may have an answer to this.
Great. That'll be unbelievably welcomed on my end. With regard to gastrointestinal distresses, some people will talk about, they're usually going to be talking about when they're consuming a powder of some kind. Do you have any thoughts on the reason that may be, other than just the individuality of it? Or one of the things I've noticed personally is that I do seem to have a threshold. I can consume maybe 40 grams of whey protein in a shake, but if I bump it up to 50 or 60, I really feel bloated, and I'll feel this gastrointestinal distress and cramping and so forth. And it doesn't seem to be that I need to, you know, double the 40 to get there. It's, you know, 10 or 20 grams more, and it seems to be just too much. Some people have some gastrointestinal distress when they consume 20 grams of a whey or an egg protein or what have you. Any thoughts on what may be causing that, other than just individual, you know, allergies or what have you?
Well, there's a couple of things. I think the first thing that came to mind is when you're consuming a powder, unfortunately, a lot of people don't mix these things very well because they're in a hurry.
Right.
And just by not mixing into a solution, you can cause some of these problems.
Oh, we are.
And it has to do with the concentration of the substance as it enters the GI tract.
Oh.
Many of these things move back and forth depending on concentration gradient. And, for instance, creatine is very difficult to get into solution. And you can get what's known as osmotic diarrhea if it's not mixed real well. And basically what happens is there is fluid moving in the reverse direction, that is, moving from the blood into the GI tract,
right,
instead of the other way around. And so as it's passing through the system, you get a very liquid stool forming, and you get a lot of gas and diarrhea. So that's the obvious thing. First of all, one should make sure these things are in solution.
And when you're saying in solution, don't put two heaping scoops of whey protein powder in 4 ounces of water.
Exactly.
Put it in 16 or whatever.
Yeah, make sure you follow the directions, because
okay.
You can run into problems. Now, with respect to the bloating and stuff, there are a lot of different individual responses, and I think all of these things need to be tried in situations where you're not involved in anything important to make sure that
right.
this isn't going to happen. I mean, you gave some numbers yourself. You know exactly what you can tolerate and what you can't.
Exactly.
And whether that's got to do with a maximum amount that you can absorb or whether it's specific to whey protein versus another protein.
Right.
A lot of these questions are ones that we didn't have even 20 years ago, because you couldn't consume that much whey protein. It wasn't available.
Exactly.
And when you start isolating food components and consuming large amounts that are not possible in food, we just have no idea what's going on. So we've got to systematically look at these things. In order to get protein in the past, we had to eat food, and now we can get it in the form of powder that's been isolated, and we can consume way more than we can in any individual food. So we need to be careful and make sure that, in fact, there aren't any problems.
Exactly. Yeah, that's excellent stuff. I had a coaching club member who asked a very good question, and I promised him that I would ask you it. It has to do with this midnight feeding. That's what we call it. We've got athletes, mostly bodybuilders or powerlifters, of course, that will wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning. They'll set an alarm sometimes, and they'll have a protein shake in the middle of the night. And his question is, does the midnight protein feeding have any impact on protein synthesis or catabolism? In other words, will drinking a shake in the middle of the night possibly reduce the amount of breakdown and hence lead to more net synthesis, blah, blah, blah. Any thoughts on this midnight feeding and getting up in the middle of the night and having a protein shake and going back to bed?
Well, I got a number of thoughts. Unfortunately, I don't have any data to back them up.
I'll take the thought.
It comes from the idea that if you're not constantly providing amino acids, you're going to get into this catabolic phase and start breaking down muscle. There is a bit of a flaw in that logic, in that there is a circulating pool of amino acids that when you eat something, it goes into that. When you break down muscle, it goes into that. So this pool is readily available to be utilized to build muscle. And I guess the question comes down to, how long can you go using that free amino acid pool before it starts limiting muscle growth?
Right.
And that's what I don't have the answer to. It's sort of related to this idea of, should you consume protein every couple of hours? And therefore, obviously, a couple of times in the night, if you're going to sleep 6-8 hours,
right,
that's the longest time you go without eating. Unfortunately, I guess the only way to really systematically prove that is to get a couple of groups of people and have some of them eat through the night, waking up with the alarm clock, as you say,
right,
and the other group not doing that, and measure over time whether there's a change in muscle strength and size. And of course, this would take many weeks of study, and you'd have a whole bunch of variables that would be very difficult to control in a human population that may be changing as well as this one particular factor relative to when they're eating. So it'd be a very difficult experiment to do, but if one did that, we might have the answer that, yeah, in fact, the guys who ate through the night,
right,
produced 10% more muscle mass.
Sure.
I'd be interested to do an experiment like that, but I doubt whether you'd show any effect, because you do have a lot of variability. You'd need a lot of subjects. And you can imagine how difficult that would be.
It'd be a fun one to recruit for, wouldn't it?
Yeah, what if somebody said, half the guys in your group that was eating, twice during the night said, well, actually, after the third night, we just gave up doing it because we didn't want to get up anymore.
Exactly.
So, it'd be very difficult to do, but it's an interesting question.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, too, in it when you think about the disruption of sleep and its possible effects.
Mm-hmm.
My goodness, there's very few things that we can do as athletes to interrupt progress than a lack of sleep.
That a lot of people don't understand, their recuperative process is critical to this whole thing.
One last question. Recently in a periodical, the authors reported on, I believe, the work of Dr. Wolf, and you've kind of addressed this earlier, and this may just be a very short answer, and that's fine, that this post-workout meal, once again, just kind of getting back to that for just a second to close here, is so important that we might want to consume up to 75% of our total daily protein requirement in the 4 hours following a workout. Any thoughts on this other than more work is needed to substantiate this or refute it?
Well, my guess is that is way, way too high.
Okay. Even if your total daily intake ends up being the 1.8 gram per kg body mass per day, if you're consuming 75% of that 1.8 in the 4 hours after a workout, it's just overload.
Yeah, that would be my guess. Again, I don't have a lot of data, but I think what you consume following the workout is going to be related to a stimulus to the process. It's not providing all of the mass of amino acids that you need. I think there's only a few of them that are critical, and somehow these few amino acids are going to turn on the process of muscle synthesis, and you'll have enough amino acids in the free pool to actually be able to increase growth. So my guess is that that's not going to be the case, and it kind of gets back to what we were just talking about. If you're consuming 75% of your daily intake at one time, then you've got these long periods when you have very little available.
Right.
And, you know, that kind of goes against that argument. But the bottom line is, I don't think anybody can answer that question,
right,
how much or even what the mixture should be. But I think everybody would agree, or most people would agree, that that post-workout time is critical. And to be safe, I think to get carbohydrate and complete protein, you know, within that first half an hour to an hour would be my recommendation at this point.
Okay, great. And I said there was one more, but I just saw in my notes here, just one thing I want to touch on. In this whole hour that we've been talking and discussing and really discovering a lot about protein, we've been talking about primarily weight trainers and so forth. But in reading your work, one of the first things when I read your work several years back that really kind of surprised me, and I saw this whole class of individuals who I think are completely unaware or were unaware of their enhanced protein needs, were, in some of your recent work continues to support this, is that people that just simply incorporate recommended increases in daily activity through exercise and endurance athletes probably have a higher need. So it's not just weightlifters, bodybuilders, powerlifters, what have you, but the endurance athletes who are preached at by everyone to consume 60 to 70% of your total macronutrients as carbohydrates, they really have a tendency to put protein way, way on the back burner. And so do the individuals who are, you know, you may want to call them weekend warriors or just, you know, transformation type people who are just trying to get in shape, and they're not going to compete and they're not at an elite level. Some of your recent work and work in the past definitely tends to indicate that endurance athletes and those people probably have increased protein needs. Do you still feel that way?
Yeah, I definitely do, and I think that the high energy expenditure of the endurance athletes, you know, compounds this a little bit. There are a lot of interactions with intense training and immune function. It could be that inadequate protein intake can contribute to that. So I think that my recommendation is for any athlete to get some good information about how much protein they're consuming. And as you know, this can be done with a simple 3-4 day diet record.
Right.
You record very accurately what you're consuming, hopefully even weighing the food so you get a very precise estimate of what you're taking in. And actually do a computer analysis of how much protein you're consuming. I find a lot of individuals who maybe are taking protein supplements when in fact their dietary protein intake is in fact adequate.
Right.
And so one needs to find out where you are before you start increasing. But there's a lot of endurance athletes who don't consume the kind of protein that we've been talking about relative to their energy expenditure.
Exactly.
And this may be why their muscle development is very reduced in the upper body. Their legs are not muscled like a bodybuilder.
Right.
The stimulus is obviously different.
Sure.
Than a repetitive exercise. But they tend to be extremely lean in the upper body, and not just fat content, but very limited muscle mass. And this may be that they're actually catabolizing upper body muscle for fuel during their long training runs. And one doesn't want to develop muscle like a bodybuilder in the upper body,
right,
of an endurance athlete. That might be counterproductive. But there may be some happy medium in between that would be advantageous for them. So I think we need to look at all active people, and certainly people that are in a growth phase. I mean, we have adolescents who are training like professional athletes, and we could actually have some impaired growth if protein intake is inadequate. The other end of the continuum, I think, are senior citizens now that are engaging in exercise, both strength and endurance. We need to study them and be sure that there aren't some significant changes in their protein needs. It may be that because of digestive changes with aging, that they actually need more protein than a younger person who is exercising at similar levels. So there's a lot of questions out there that we can still answer.
In the work that, just as you had mentioned too, with the elderly, with regard to exercise and weight training, it's just a mound of research on that particular segment of the population, and with good reason, of course, because of their functional needs, and the functionality goes down, generally speaking, as people get older, unless they're exercising or remain very active. And they seem like the studies, just one right after another, it always benefits them. And they have still, it appears anyway, significant ability to add muscle if they engage in some kind of a, you know, a very well thought out, well planned exercise regimen, including weight-bearing exercise. They all seem to still be able to put on muscle, unless, like you're saying, if their protein needs aren't being met, it would only make sense that that would be impaired.
For those elderly listeners who aren't familiar with the data, increases in the range of 200% are very typical. So if one thinks about doubling your strength,
it's
incredible. And
it is.
And the other thing that's very important is that because this exercise is self-limiting, there's very few injuries. There doesn't seem to be cardiovascular risk
exactly
associated with this type of exercise, because as you get older, you're limited in how much you can lift. So there's probably less risk with this type of activity than there is with aerobic type of training. So it's interesting, you know, tremendous gains and very little risk. It's very exciting, and I would like to see strength programs being utilized much more with the elderly, in both healthy and even in convalescent homes. We can start off with very, very easy exercise, but for the individual, represents the difficulty that a young person would have. And then, as you said, the gains are just phenomenal.
They are. It's just one study after another. It's not like in some areas of research where there's limited data. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And the benefits of exercise and weight training and remaining really, really active, you know, middle-aged and elderly and well beyond.
I guess it's never too late. The muscle is a very plastic tissue that will continue to adapt regardless of age.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Dr. Lemon, for taking time out of your busy schedule to provide us with a much stronger foundation for making the right decision unique to each of us with regard to protein intake for optimal health and performance.
You're welcome, Dave. I enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you for listening. To learn more about the Leanness Lifestyle and Club Lifestyle online, please visit www.leannesslifestyle.com. That's www.leannesslifestyle.com.